Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Bluetooth mess, you know, for the Internet of Things. AMD Radeon Vega Frontier Edition, liquid-cooled Dell's XPS 27 all-in-one quad-core Kaby Lake R CPUs, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 424, recorded on July 20th, 2017. Bluetooth will run everything. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most engaging, most informative, most delightful, and occasionally the chipperest news in PC, mobile, desktop, portable, Internet of Things, or the Internet of Stuff, as some people would call it. We loves the hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Shrout, or almost always. You did something scary. You bought a battery off of eBay to put in your production laptop.
Well, yes. Yes. So basically what happened is I have a Broadwell E XPS 13 that has just shown the signs of battery age, right? Where the charges just don't last as long. Battery life is just noticeably lower than it used to be. So I asked some people at Dell, and they don't actually sell the batteries for this laptop anymore. You can't buy a new one. So I did what you do next, and you go look around, right? So you went on Amazon or eBay or whatever, and I found one that, you know, said it was new, and I looked at the pictures of it, and it seemed to match up with all the labeling and description of the one I have. It has the same part number listed. So I was like, okay. It was like $29 plus shipping or something like that. I was like, okay, we'll give this a shot. And got it in. You know, went through like a battery test on the current state of my laptop just so I could have a good before after type thing. You know, took it apart. It's not like a easily replaceable battery. You got to take the whole back of the laptop off. But once you get in there, it's not that big of a problem. Swapped it in. Tried to turn it on. It wouldn't turn on. I go, oh, okay. Well, clearly the battery is just completely dead. And plug it into AC and turn it on and it works. And it boots up, and it's actually now it says it has 100% battery. And I go, well, that's pretty odd. And then I realized that the light on the front of the machine that is white when it's charging or plugged in or orange when it's low is just flashing orange continuously. And I'm like, okay, that's weird. So then I just unplug the AC from it, and the whole machine shuts down. I'm like, okay. Battery. Maybe I installed the battery incorrectly. So I take it apart again. I look through it. I make sure the connection is in tight from the battery. You know, everything's there. And the same behavior repeats itself. So that battery was bad. And then I called up some friends at Dell and I said, hey, I had this happen. Do you have any somewhere? And so they ended up going and they found an XPS 13 in the lab that they took salvaged the battery out of to send to me. And I went through that replacement process and it works. And it works just fine. But I've now, when I say power cycled it, I mean like fully charged it, fully discharged it, fully charged it, fully discharged it three times now. And the battery life is almost identical to the old battery I had. So I don't know if the battery they sent me was just it had gone through a lot of charge cycles as well or what. So now I'm at this point now where I feel like in order to get better battery life, I need to like buy a new laptop. And that's a bad feeling. But it's kind of the.
Is it a very specific battery sort of size or layout? There's no.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what gets really frustrating because with a lot of devices, you start getting into, you know, at one point you would open up a device, let's say an early iPod, and it would be sort of a standard, lithium ion or polymer battery, lithium ion polymer battery pack inside of there. And, you know, obviously you couldn't buy one from Apple, but you could buy one from a reputable source that would be in decent shape. And as the design of the battery becomes more, sort of integrated to the design of the device, especially as devices get thinner and thinner. It seems like it's getting harder and harder in some cases to find batteries that will actually work in a given application.
Yeah. I mean, they're very thin because, you know, you're going into like ultra thin and light laptops. No, I wouldn't expect to be able to use any other kind of battery just with it. I have like and the sad part is I have an external battery, like Dell sells an accessory, like 20,000 milliamp hour or whatever kind of like external battery that will both charge your laptop and other USB devices. And I've had that for the same amount of time, and its battery life has also kind of degraded in the standard LiPo life cycle of things. It sucks, right? Because we see this on phones, and we see this on laptops, and we see this on anything that's kind of battery powered these days. And it's not something we really think about when you're doing like a review or analysis or a recommendation, because it's not something you can even figure out until years into the life cycle of that product. And then very much it depends on what your usage of it was. Like I happened to go into the firmware on this, like the BIOS essentially on this Dell XPS 13. And there's actually settings in there that are meant to maximize the life of the battery. For example, you can have it charge more slowly if you tell it, I'm almost always plugged in, so don't try to charge these batteries fast, because that will degrade the life of the battery more quickly, those types of things. So there's interesting settings in here, and I feel like that's maybe an area of expansion, of growth, of research that could be improved upon on all these things, because everybody has the complaint on their iPhone or on their you know, MacBook or whatever it happens to be. But nobody talks. I don't think I've ever seen a product release where they talk about like the life cycle of their battery. Like, hey, this battery is going to last you at least 2 years or at least 4 years without degradation and that type of stuff. And as an owner of an electric car, I kind of, you know, now make those same types of questions and whatnot. So it'll be interesting to see.
Will be interesting to see. Something that I thought was a little odd came out this week was that the Bluetooth consortium has announced that they are bringing mesh networking to Bluetooth, and so Bluetooth SIG, Bluetooth 4 and 5 devices will be able to communicate in a mesh network. And when you go to the release on the Bluetooth SIG website, it is ideally suited for building automation, sensor networks, and other Internet of Things solutions where tens, hundreds, or thousands of devices need to reliably and securely communicate with one another. And all I could think was, like, isn't this what Zigbee and Z-Wave were built for, like, 10 years ago? You know, except this is being done by the Bluetooth Consortium Zigbee's a little, you know, proprietary. Z-Wave is a little more open, or at least was back in the day. You know, and it's I'm very curious to see what happens, right? Because, you know, when you look at this, they've got a lot of quotes, right? Because like almost everything announced in the world of Bluetooth, you get an announcement, and then several decades later, it seems like products start to ship using the technology. But or at least it's the way it feels. You know, the vice president of marketing, wireless business unit from ARM, the addition of mesh to the Bluetooth standard will open up significant opportunities for richer experiences in smart homes and building automation, enabling fresh waves of innovation across a range of IoT applications. Low power connectivity is essential to bringing the next generation of secure IoT devices to life. You know, also putting secure and IoT in the same sentence is pretty amusing at this point. But, you know, this is also Bluetooth trying to remain viable in an era when, you know, billions and billions and billions, like tens of billions of Internet of Things randomness are going to be stuffed into your home. You know, I'll be really curious, like, you know, was everybody waiting for Bluetooth? But then again, I don't really see how that's going to work. What's pretty crazy is, you know, they're claiming Bluetooth mesh can extend Bluetooth range up to 200 meters, which is pretty huge. Or I should say some of their customers are saying Bluetooth mesh can extend the range of their products up to 200 meters. So I'm kind of curious to see how this gets implemented and what, what we see it first rolling out in. Because, like, I think they started writing about mesh back in 2014, probably the first time I saw something on the Bluetooth.com website on that. You know, it's also interesting to watch consumer pubs, you know, like The Verge. Bluetooth is getting a big upgrade to make it better for smart homes, and everything you look at on the website is radically, tightly focused on enterprise and massive office buildings and, you know, production environments and asset tracking over active RFID. Right. I was curious, you know, and one of the other lines that I saw somewhere type is, oh, just what we need, another smart home standard.
Yeah, that one's not, you know, wrong. Yeah. I do like, I like the idea of just extending Bluetooth range through the mesh networking idea. Like even in like our office space like this, it would just kind of be nice if like, hey, every computer that has Bluetooth on it, just turn on the Bluetooth, right, and it's providing some range extension for other products as you move around.
It's not
right,
but range extension like, you know, I put an antenna on my Wi-Fi adapter, or I bought a Wi-Fi adapter with increased sensitivity and a better antenna. It's literally going to have to hop from, you know, Bluetooth device to Bluetooth device to Bluetooth device to Bluetooth device, and they're all going to have Bluetooth 4 or 5, and they're all going to have the firmware updates that make this actually work, which, if you're familiar with Internet of Things devices, there's lots of things that would make this really useful that will probably never receive any firmware updates that would make it possible for that. I'll be curious, right? Because, you know, a lot of the things that they're trying to solve with this have already been solved in other areas. Where it gets really interesting is when you're talking about super ultra low power devices that don't need to sort of ping back very often. I love that it doesn't require new hardware. I love that it's compatible with Bluetooth 4 and Bluetooth 5. And the Bluetooth SIG, by the way, did tell The Verge that they expect to see new Bluetooth standards entering the market about 6 months after they're released. And they expect Bluetooth mesh to show up even sooner. So I would like to officially not rescind, but suggest that my, you know, thoughts on Bluetooth seeming to be announced years before it shows up, maybe inaccurate. I don't know. I was also, I got to say, shocked that you are not ready to buy the spectacles on Amazon.
Exactly.
You went out of your way to tweet your distinct lack of interest.
It was a simple answer of somebody tweeted that you can buy spectacles on Amazon, and I simply retweeted no, and that was it.
Not your thing?
Not my line. No. No.
I don't know, man. You could rock those things.
Do you have a couple of pair already or something?
Oh, God, no. You know, it would be tempting if I had any interest in round photos, round video, or wandering around looking like a total creeper. These things make... I was at VidCon, and, you know, teenagers wandering around with spectacles look peculiar. And I think adults wandering around with snap spectacles would look downright creepy. I could be wrong about that. Yeah. Feel free to tweet at Patrick Norton or email me, but it was a funny moment. Man,
make sure you get the teal ones.
There's nothing wrong with teal sunglasses, man. No. I mean, they might clash with your hair aggressively, but
probably. I think I could pull them off. I mean, I think I could do it.
I don't know if you heard that behind me, but I've been wiping, because I got to return it to Dell, the XPS 27/77/60 all-in-one, and in the process of you know, wiping it, it goes in the reboot process, and then Cortana suddenly started speaking behind me.
For Windows setup.
Yes, which I'm just finding, speaking of spectacles and creepiness, more and more peculiar each time I do it. It's interesting. It always used to be like you could get it all in one. It would look really, really good. you know, it would look kind of fabulous. And you'd have, you know, typical to mediocre laptop performance. And that was the thing that really stood out for me, taking a look at the Dell XPS 27, that it is not slow. And I mean that in the best possible way. Core i7, you know, like a Core i7 7700, pardon me. Core i7, 7700, 16 gigabytes of RAM, 64 gigabytes max, which was really kind of exciting as an option. Gorgeous 27-inch 4K monitor, an AMD RX 570 GPU, which, you know, you and I were texting about. Because when I first fired up Rocket League on the XPS 2700, the graphics were set to a 1920 by 1440, which is a 4x3 mode with black bars on the side, which is kind of awkward when you're looking at a 4K monitor. I ended up resetting Rocket League to like 2048 by 1152, which filled the monitor. There's a fair amount of tearing. But the thing that kind of struck me is as much as I would like to see more graphic power to back up a 4K monitor, I just want to say 6.5% faster than the Core i7-6700 desktop I built, back in the early 2015, late 2015. And the gaming was just fine. You can get up to 64 gigabytes of RAM in it. So if you're looking for an all-in-one that's not going to cripple you with using Photoshop or video editing, if you are a super elite hacker gamer and you need all of the refresh rate, this is probably not the design for you. But it was amazing for me, you know, just being like, this is an all-in-one. It renders video as fast as my desktop at home. Admittedly, a year-old desktop at home, but it's not like there's been huge leaps between the 6700 and the 7700 in terms of performance. It has a massive amount of RAM that you can upgrade to. It's got two 2.5-inch drive slots. It's got an M.2 space on the motherboard, so you can put a fair amount of storage into it. It's a little odd. Most of the configurations on it come with a 32 gigabytes M.2 SATA SSD cache and like a 1 or 2 terabyte 5400 RPM hard drive. So that'll speed up your operating system and your frequently used apps, but I would almost immediately want to upgrade that to a standard SSD. And like I said, there's two 2.5-inch drive slots inside of there. So there's room to expand memory. There's room to expand, the storage inside of that. Touchscreen's optional. So if you buy the before I talk about the touchscreen, the speakers on this are kind of insane. They've got what amounts to a 100-watt sound bar built into the bottom of the monitor, and they are very, very proud. There's a couple of passive radiators. So on the outside, there's a tweeter. You know, there's two like mid ranges, and in a full firing or a full range speaker firing down, and then with that other speaker on the back, a passive radiator on the back to help the boost. It's pretty crazy. Four full range drivers, two tweeters, the two full range drivers that point down, and the passive radiators on the back, and it was like really impressive sound staging. For recordings that have it, Amber Rubar's Sessions from the 13 Ward comes to mind. You know, some really nice detail on the highs on Coltrane's Love Supreme. What's frustrating, though, is they did all this work on building these incredible speakers into it, and they're great for casual listening, but it just drops off a cliff below 70 hertz. Like the thud of the impacts in Kung Fu Panda weren't there. Kick drums don't have a lot of impact. You know, like Rage Against the Machine, there was like a lot of the low-end presence or clutch wasn't there, which was a little disappointing because beyond that, they're pretty amazing audio wise. Although I will say, with a 4-mic desk, those downward firing full range speakers seem to bounce a little bit, not quite too much, but almost too much treble. You can see the basic version. There's a basic stand that comes with the non-touchscreen version. The touchscreen version adds $400 to the price, but it allows you to collapse the thing down into a flat mode in front of you. I could have used a couple more inches of height. Yeah, there, you can see it right there. But if you're into touchscreens, it's an option. I got to say, I would probably not spring the extra $400 for the touchscreen. I'd buy a 1 terabyte hard drive SSD for that. the touchscreen worked, you know, it worked like a touchscreen. It worked perfectly fine. It's an incredibly shiny monitor, which isn't too bad in my office environment. But if you like to work with, you know, giant sunny windows, you're probably going to want to take care in positioning it. I was really, like I said, it was really kind of amazing to use an all-in-one that, you know, not only looked good, but delivered decent performance. Maybe not for hardcore gamers, but if you're talking about, like, you know, video editing or playing with audio or stuff like that. The one thing it did drive me nuts is the webcams on that are all the way down at the bottom of the monitor, much like the XPS 13. So they're giving you this, like, sweet infinity edge kind of bezel design.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got the, you know, this look, which is not attractive for anyone, as near as I can tell, for the webcam. But starts at 1550 with a Core i5 7400 and 8 gigs of RAM and a 1 terabyte hard drive. Tops out at $2,800 with a Core i7 7700, 16 gigs of RAM, a 4K touchscreen, and that 512 gigabyte SSD. I liked it. I really, really would like to see the webcam at the top, even if that means increasing the bezel size a little bit. It also does the IR camera, so you can get Windows Hello going. You know, and if you're a hardcore gamer, you would probably want something with a little more GPU power. But for casual gaming for Rocket League, as soon as I started playing, I didn't really think twice about it.
Very cool.
You know, yeah, I was impressed by that one. The because I used a couple different all-in-ones for years, and invariably there was always another computer nearby that I would have to do the serious stuff on,
right?
Like rendering video or ripping stuff. So, you did you do the live benchmarking stream of AMD's liquid-cooled version of the Vega Frontier Edition? And if you did, was it amazing? And tell me, does liquid cooling double the performance of the Vega Frontier Edition?
Let's see. No, we did not live stream it. Mostly because I didn't expect there to be a significant difference, and I knew I was going to have to break up the testing over two days because it was getting late. So we ended up not doing a live stream. Is it doubling performance or 50% more performance? No. I will say that the amount of added gaming performance that we got out of the water-cooled variant of the Vega Frontier Edition compared to the air-cooled was more than I expected. Somewhere around 10 to 12, 10 to 14% kind of across the six different games that we looked at, which is interesting because, like, the raw specifications are the same. What differs is the thermal solution, which then allows the card, you know, interestingly, out of the box, the liquid cooled version hits the same TDP as the air cooled, like it's in its 300 watt setting, but there's a little switch on top behind the liquid cooling cables, the cables going into the card from the radiator and whatnot. That is like a BIOS switch, and you turn that switch to the other position and reboot your machine, and you're in the 350 watt version of it. And when you're in the 350 watt, you know, the GPU gets a little bit warmer, but it's still like it's 70 C or below, way below what the air cooled card was running at, which was like 80-85 C. And it does that. So, and when the GPU is running at that thermal stability, the clocks are more, it hits the highest TDP, not hits it, it hits the highest clock states that it can more often. Right. So at 350 watts, you're averaging, you know, 80 to 100 megahertz faster than on the air cooled when you're in a 350 watt state. And as a result, performance goes up a little bit. And in general, the frame time variance is lower because it's not switching clock speeds as much. Now, there are still it's a good looking card, by the way. It's the inverse of the air cooled one. The air cooled one was blue with yellow accents. This one's like a yellowish gold with blue accents. I will say that I hate blue LEDs, and there are a lot of them on this card, so keep that in mind. The water cooling pump is interesting because it's not just a like a circulation. It's not like a recirculation reciprocal pump. It's a diaphragm pump inside of it, which is fairly unique to
exactly. Does it do the
fish tank style sound? Now, and it's quiet. It's quieter than the air cooled card, and it's not louder than other self-contained water coolers, but it just sounds different. Which it's hard to describe, but Alan kind of equated it to something like an older fish tank pump would be, and I think that's pretty close. So a couple of things on the power consumption. So 300 and 350 watts are kind of like the two settings available in the card. Clock speeds go up a little bit. If you look at our overclocking page, which is the last one, you'll see that we were able to push. So first things first, like if you just take the power target, which now in AMD cards with Polaris, starting with Polaris, kind of works just like it does on NVIDIA cards. You just increase the power target, you know, like plus 25%. It raises the power draw, but you get almost a static 1600 megahertz clock speed, which is what the rated clock of the card is, right? So that increases your power draw, but you get a more stable, higher average clock speed. I was able to do plus 25% power, plus 7% on the GPU clock, which takes the rated GPU clock to 1712. But in reality, we were bouncing between 1712 and 1637, kind of back and forth on that page. The bigger problem, and that's good, right? So we saw some performance benefit there. However, this comes at the cost of power, where in its overclocked state, this card was drawing about 440 watts of power, which is considerable, right? So keeping in mind that the 1080 Ti, that is the flagship kind of best consumer grade, consumer priced, gaming card from NVIDIA, uses 250 watts. Realize that in one of the out-of-box states, depending on the position of the switch, the Vega FE liquid-cooled uses 350 watts, so already 100 watts more than that. And then we're getting 90 watts more than that even to get to this overclocked state. And you start to understand kind of the extremity of the efficiency advantage the Pascal has at its performance level over Vega. But it is worth noting that even not overclocked, with the liquid cooler running at higher clocks just because of it running the GPU at a cooler state, the performance was getting pretty close to the 1080. And I think Dirt Rally, it was actually at 4K, it was a little bit ahead of the GTX 1080. And that 10 to 12% difference pushed it way, way closer to 1080 than the 1070, whereas the air-cooled card was way, way closer to the 1070 than the 1080. So it's an interesting kind of experimental card, because I would never recommend somebody buy this. It's $1,500. It's $500 more than the air-cooled card. It's a significant investment. AMD claims this card is targeted at some kind of in-between area of high-end gaming and professional users, and that's fine or whatever. I was more using it as a data point for what do we know about Vega? What are we learning about the RX Vega that's going to come out at the end of the month or early in August or whatever it's going to be? And it basically gave me more hope than I had before that AMD may be able to produce a part that is competitive with the GTX 1080. Now, I don't think it's going to be ahead of the GTX 1080, and it's not going to get up to the 1080 Ti. The 1080 Ti was still on average 25 to 35% faster than this liquid-cooled version of the Vega Frontier Edition. But it does mean that, when it was closer to the 1070, you realized that Vega had to confront this $399 price tag. At 1080 levels of performance, they can now target a $499 price tag. And then they just get to make decisions on how aggressive they want to be in terms of how much margin they want to have in it, if any. And then, are they going to try to basically make the argument that we're going to match 1080 performance and match 1080 pricing and know that some people are going to buy our products? Are they going to try to, maybe be $20, $30 less expensive so that they can claim to have better performance per dollar, even though it is going to be at a much worse performance per watt? have a complicated discussion to have over the next couple of weeks, I think.
Is performance per watt as important as a lot of graphics card vendors want us to think it is? I mean, performance per watt is a big deal. If you're thinking about we're going to take over the enterprise market and we need to make sure that, cooling doesn't need to be turned up in data centers. I get that. And I get on some level, that reducing power consumption is generally always a good thing. But if you're I'm going for power users that probably already have a 600, or 800 or 1,000 watt GPU or power supply that they're, using 300 or 400 watts on, is it, you know, is power consumption going to be that big a deal? I mean, I would think not.
So,
or are they just afraid they're going to get hammered by NVIDIA's marketing?
No, I mean, they're definitely going to do that. I mean, you're correct in that performance per watt to the consumer means way less than performance per dollar. But when your performance per dollar is the same or very close between two products, then the differentiation points start to mean more after that, right? So now you're talking about like, okay, which one has the better driver ecosystem? Which one of these has, you know, has the lower noise fans? Which one of these is going to draw less power? I don't have to have as big a heatsink or power supply, sorry. And keep in mind that it's not an insignificant difference, right? The GTX 1080, not the 1080 Ti, the 1080 is a 180-watt card. And AMD's Vega Frontier Edition, in this case, with the liquid cooler, to pretty much match performance, is 350 watts. So you're talking about a 170-watt difference, almost double the power necessary for this card.
Maybe that didn't sink in now, the first time.
Well, and I kept comparing it to the 1080 Ti power as well. And so, you know, that's the difference of, you know, you need a 500-watt power supply to run a 1080 with a processor and all that type of stuff versus, you know, needing a 700-watt power supply or something like that, right? Like there is a difference in, you know, if you're drawing 175 watts more power to get the same level of performance, that's a lot. Do I think it's going to prevent enthusiasts and DIY and builders from buying these cards? I really don't, because you can find 700-watt, 600-watt power supplies. You're going to be able to do this, and it's not, they're not going to be super expensive, and you know, all these types of things, if as long as AMD makes all the right decisions in terms of positioning and pricing and that type of stuff. So no, it's not as important, but assuming that everybody's intelligent enough to make, and by everybody, I mean AMD and NVIDIA, to make these things price competitive, price per performance per dollar competitive, then you have no choice but to look at the other things, right? The other parts of the ecosystem, software, power draw, features, game support, that type of stuff. So it's, I think it will be important, but yeah, I don't know. We'll see. There are still some people out there that believe that AMD has some magic card up its sleeve that's going to make up 20% in performance through drivers and enabling a different rasterizer or tile-based rasterization and the high bandwidth cache controller. And I don't believe any of this is true. I think they might be able to find another 5-7% somewhere. But then keep in mind that, like, when they come up with the RX Vega, they'll have a water-cooled card.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to have not water-cooled options too. And so those cards' performance, we already kind of know where that's going to be, right? Unless they depend on third-party cooler designs that are going to be more efficient without being noisy, like the blower style that we see in the reference design, the Frontier Edition. So, see in like 2 weeks.
I was also going to say the same people who believe that there's magic drivers are probably also the one who are going to buy AMD no matter what the power delta is or the thermal delta, the TDP.
Yeah. There are definitely some of those.
There are a few of those. On a completely random note, Intel has apparently shut down its entire. I mean, they had been working towards, you know, okay, we're going to do these low end parts for Internet of Things, and now their entire smartwatch and fitness tracker group has apparently been. 80% of the team, CNBC says, that made the basic smartwatch in November has been laid off. The entire division has been eliminated. And they're apparently refocusing on virtual reality. You know, which reminds me of a number of the chases we've seen Microsoft doing over the past few years. Intel is now all about the VR. And the other thing that was interesting is Microsoft, of all people, have unveiled a Cortana-powered thermostat called Glass. They're working with Johnson Controls to build it, Johnson Controls being very, very big in HVAC, because apparently they needed something running Windows 10 Internet of Things Core Edition. This is right up on the cards that I caught on this one.
Okay.
Yeah, I you know, no, I mean, literally, like, that was literally my reaction. you know, as Intel's abandoning the Internet of Things and, you know, the company that kind of invented it, Nest, may or may not be spinning in circles. Personally, if I was buying a new thermostat right now, I would probably be buying an Ecobee 3, you know, or an Ecobee 3 Lite. Although I understand that the newer versions of the Nest Learning thermostat are considerably better than the one I bought. There's things I love about the Nest thermostat, but there are so many features on it that were just abysmal. For example, when it would try to turn the you know, heat off in the house because nobody was there, despite the fact that my wife and children were in the same room as the thermostat. that and adding new thermal settings at the drop of a hat was a little frustrating. But the I just thought it was fascinating, you know, like, so you're going to have Cortana voice control built into a thermostat from Microsoft. So no idea. You know, it's funny because, you know, Nest can, you know, I'm very curious. You know, there's no reason you couldn't do this with like a Skylark control system. Sorry, everybody. And I'm also very curious to see what the pricing on this is going to be, because the design looks absolutely fabulous. You can see that sort of see-through screen, the wall mounting. Yeah, that's also probably a rendering and not an actual real object, but. I'm curious that, you know, I'm down with the translucent touchscreen display. I'm terrified by what the pricing on that's going to be.
Yes.
in more rational numbers, or more rational thoughts from Intel, or actually I'm sure, you know, laying off people is perfectly rational. And I'm sorry for everybody who got shut down in that, round of layoffs, but, quad-core Kaby Lake R CPUs for ultra portables. What are we going to see performance-wise on these? Do you have a guess?
So there's actually been some leaks into like something like Geekbench, right? Of some of these model numbers already. And I think if you look in Ken's story, he talks about if you compare the Core i5-8520U, which is apparently the quad-core hyper-threaded Kaby Lake R versus the 7200U, you see a 54% increase in multi-threaded performance and a 7% increase in single-threaded performance. The cool thing about this potential rumor, which seems pretty likely with all the data coming around, is that you're going to get 15-watt parts that now have quad-core hyper-threaded integration on
right.
them. Right. Which basically means – go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's what has me excited, because a lot of the low power parts have been fine as long as you didn't stray away from like, I'm typing into a Google Doc, I'm opening a Google Sheet, I'm sending an email. But as soon as you try to do anything more taxing to the processor, you know, your experience would just nosedive. So I'm kind of excited about a 15 watt part with quad cores.
Because the problem is if you wanted to buy a quad core, actual quad core laptop, you pretty much had to sacrifice look and style and kind of like the thin and light designs that you wanted. And in generally, you know, you had lower quality features, lower quality displays, not always, but sometimes. And with offering a 15-watt version, it now means you can get the potential of that performance in all kinds of different form factors. Now, there's other things to think about. If the leaked specs from this Acer Swift 3 are true, right? They list a base clock of 1.6 and a boost clock of 3.4, turbo clock. Mm-hmm. That's a huge gap, right? That's almost a 2 gigahertz gap between base and the turbo boost, which is indicative of the thermal envelope and environment that it has to work in. Basically, because the base clock is like what they guarantee all these cores are going to be able to work at with the cooling solutions necessary for the 15-watt environment, right? So,
right.
If you're doing like an hour long render, chances are you're going to run close down to these base clocks, where you're utilizing all 8 threads at one time. If, however, you are doing something like a Photoshop a filter effect or something like that maybe takes 5 seconds to run on a large image that you're editing, chances are you'll be able to use all quad cores, all 4 of those cores, for that full 5 seconds at close to that max turbo speed, maybe 3.2 or 3.3 or 3.0 or whatever it's going to be, because the the laws of thermodynamics say the processor and the heatsink don't heat up instantly. It takes a little time. So as long as the processor is down into its lower state quickly enough, you don't have to worry about overheating any of the components inside. So that's kind of like what I imagine the difference is going to be in these parts. Is the bigger machines that are going to have 35 watt parts are just going to say, hey, we can run fully loaded for longer periods of time at higher clock speeds. Whereas on the 15 watt iterations, it's for more of those short bursts of when do you need quad core computing, right? But still being able to get up into as high as 3.4 in your single threaded workloads for snappy responsiveness, touchscreen interaction, all that type of stuff that still really matters for this class of machine.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think it'll be interesting. There are also some people who have, I think, erroneously been reporting that the 8000 series were Coffee Lake when they're not, at least according to all this data. They're still Kaby Lake, not a new architecture, just a different kind of packaging and binning of parts.
Good to know. Yeah. Memory price has been up a little bit, driven primarily by the extraordinary amount of RAM being put into, amongst other things, cell phones in China, and the ramping up of memory being needed for more and more things out there in the universe, including automotive applications. Samsung has increased the production of the industry's fastest DRAM, 8 gigabyte HBM2, to address rapidly growing market demand. So, was Alan particularly excited about this, or is this kind of something that seems obvious? Because, you know, apparently RAM is back, baby.
Well, so this is the HBM2 stuff is not, that's Vega uses HBM2, right?
Right. I mean, it is incredibly high end. I should not conflate this with the DRAM that's being used on phones or the, you know, desktop computer. My bad. Sorry.
I was trying to figure out how I was going to say, like, so basically if you look at a lot of the problems surrounding AMD's Vega release is about the high cost of HBM2 memory. They made a decision years ago to go with HBM2. And as it turns out, it kind of bit them in the butt because they don't have, access to high volume HBM2 production. At least they have it until this announcement, essentially. So that's why one of the reasons why Vega, RX Vega, Vega Frontier Edition are high priced, and or they're going to have to really sacrifice their margin to kind of get prices where they need to be to compete against the GeForce line. An announcement of like Samsung is kind of interesting for two reasons. One, it indicates that they're going to ramp up production, which should increase volume, which means it should, in theory, lower the cost of that memory to AMD and AMD's partners so that they can make these chips and either sell them for the price that they want to sell them at or make a little bit more money while they're selling it at the price that they wanted to sell it at. What we really need is like the second SK Hynix has announced HBM2, but only 4 gigabyte stacks, not 8 gigabyte stacks. Everybody kind of assumes that they're going to have an 8 gigabyte stack production line come up relatively soon. The sooner the better, as it means that we will be able to see lower cost iterations of this, right? Because AMD is betting big on HBM, right? Not just for the super high end. Like the mainstream this generation will still use GDDR5, 5X, 6, whatever it's going to be. But like 2018, AMD on its roadmap still kind of says like, hey, we're going to use HBM memory, HBM2, like all the way down to the budget products. And if you're going to do that, that has to be a very high volume, low cost integration. So, these ramp ups are important. I think Samsung might also be ramping it up, trying to kind of counter any momentum that SK Hynix might make by making their announcements, because they want to kind of make sure they're the single best customer for that. But, It's good to see. It's kind of like an inside baseball news story, but it's good to see in relation to like, hey, if you care about Vega and AMD's future product roadmap, you want news like that to come out. Not that things are slowing down installing, but instead the opposite. Things are ramping up and producing and becoming a higher volume as quickly as possible.
This is a good thing. Yeah. You've been thinking about the Core i9 7900 X series processor. With its price tag and its cost and motherboards. Pretty good article up on hardocp.com on overclocking the Intel Core i9 7900 series. I love the fact, if you go to the second page and scroll down, you'll see a shot of a multimeter reading temperatures. And one of the things they've done at HardOCP for years is they basically turn off the 120 millimeter fan just to see what happens. Quote, not every motherboard is up to 100% full load with zero airflow across the motherboard. And as you know, this is not something you should be doing anyway, as it's stupid. It's bad for your entire system to run a computer in a hot box. And they note that even on their open test bench with an ambient temperature of around 75 degrees, the X299 platform does not last long in terms of operating with no airflow. You know, the crew at HardOCP says, you know, nothing wrong with the X299 platform in terms of power. It's an HEDT system. But if you are going to be, getting serious about overclocking, quote, I do think the X299 motherboard platform is getting near its limits in terms of enthusiast overclocking. Beyond air and water cooling your CPU, I do not think the X299 platform will show to be a long-term stable solution. Because Eufy tweaking and system cooling, you're going to have to be at your best. That's a pretty serious rig they put together for this one. So,
yeah.
You know, they are stretching it out to its limits. I also love the fact that, you know, they do the kill test where they they turn the fan off. Do not do that at home.
That sounds like a bad idea.
Generally speaking, it is not a positive thing to do. Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to get the new BIOS running on my Ryzen 1800X, which should allow me to do some significantly improved memory tuning on that one. So see if we can get that loaded on there this week and report back on that next week. PCPro.com, ladies and gentlemen, that's where you can find more of Mr. Ryan Schrautz. And anything you can tease yet, or is it all under the NDAs at this point?
Oh, man. Let's see. So if people have questions, thoughts, ideas that they want to see me answer as I stare into a webcam for 20 minutes, I'm trying to do like a weekly, just like Ryan's rants type thing, where people send me ideas and topics and I talk about it. So if you want to tweet me at Ryan Schrout, I'm probably going to record that tonight or tomorrow morning and try to have it up for over the weekend and see if anybody gives a crap about that type of stuff. Ryzen 3 is coming out on July 27th. We're currently testing that. So we'll have some answers in terms of the budget end of AMD's Ryzen family and how it compares to nice. Core i3 through a different bunch of different stuff. And then I guess next, not this coming weekend, but the next weekend is like when all the SIGGRAPH, AMD, like Vega, Threadripper stuff is all occurring. So, we're creeping up to, I mean, Lisa Su, the CEO of AMD, said we'd have Threadripper in early August. I don't know what day that means yet, but soon still, I guess.
Early August is coming up on us.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
I'm curious.
Kind of shocking.
For the AMD. Yeah, it's the children, man. They make everything go faster. Man, like the Ryzen 3 1300X, which is quad core, mm-hmm. 3.5 gigahertz. The rumors on Reddit right now are that could be as little as $129. Which parts are you most excited about from Ryzen 3?
Honestly, the cheap, well, I think they're going to be close enough in price that it's not going to be a huge difference, but the cheaper one, if it's, $100 to $120, something like that, is going to be really competitive, mm-hmm. right? So you've got things like the Intel G4560 to compare it to, Core i3-7300 to compare it to, these are true quad cores without SMT. Whereas the Core right. i3s are dual core with hyper threading. So I'm very curious to see, we still expect Intel to have single threaded performance advantages, although at the Core i3 lineup, they don't clock them exceptionally high. So it's possible that maybe AMD is a little bit closer in single threaded results than they have been on the Ryzen 5 and Ryzen 7. I don't know. But the multi-threaded workloads, I think we'll show a pretty big advantage to Ryzen, maybe. I think What Ryzen 7 did was it was competitive with some of the HEDT Broadwell E line. Ryzen 5 was surprisingly competitive with Core i7 in some cases. And then I think we'll see Ryzen 3 be competitive with the Core i5 in some cases, especially when we're talking about multi-threaded workloads. And that's really AMD's sales pitch to the community and to, you know, OEMs and stuff, is like, yeah, we're not going to win everything, but in the areas where we win, we're like, we win pretty heavily, and we're more cost effective, right? So, and that's what they're doing with Threadripper. That's what they're going to do with Ryzen. It's what they're doing with Epic. It's a very centralized plan on the CPU side from top down.
Now, I know, the pricing of these is significantly reduced. Is the Ryzen 3 using the same socket as the rest of the Ryzen lineup, or the rest of the, okay. It seems like Asus and ASRock were preparing some less expensive AM4 motherboards to go along with these, or these just motherboards that were coming out much later than the rest of the lineup.
So the chipsets remain the same. You've got the X370, which is going to be the high end. I don't imagine you'll see Ryzen 3 being paired with those motherboards. B350, and then you've got the A320, I think is what it's called. And that is basically, like, all of them are feature equivalent, except for, like, the X370 supports multi-GPU. The bottom ones don't. The B350 supports overclocking, but the A320 does not. So, like, the A320 is missing overclocking and multi-GPU. And then the B350 is only missing multi-GPU, and the X370 has all of those. So, I think there are quite a few low-cost B350 motherboards that will make sense for Ryzen 3. I think the performance will be good enough, especially for, like, things like gaming, where quad-core, like true quad-core, will be advantageous over two-core hyper-threading. You know, you can put a 1060, 1070, you know, a moderate to high-end GPU in these systems and still have a really good overall, solution for that without having to go up to Ryzen 7 or up to Core i7 to make it happen. So I haven't seen any of the A320 motherboards myself yet, so I don't know exactly, you know, how bare bones budget these are going to be. So even though the chipsets might be feature equivalent, it doesn't mean the board vendors implement all of the same technologies on them. So, like, are A320 boards going to be, you know, without M.2 ports or something like that, or only have two SATA ports or four SATA ports or whatever it's going to be. Things to keep in mind as you look around at the budget end of that.
When you look at A320 boards, it's also amazing. Like, you're looking at $70 to $90, and a B350 board is starting at $89. So if you're never going to overclock, A320 makes sense, but you're not saving a huge amount of money going to an A320 powered motherboard. Here's one that's down to like $320. Here's one that's down to $62, an A320M that's down to $62, but you're still talking about $27. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So the July 27th is supposed to be the launch date. Is that going to be when they start selling them, or are they going to sort of build the hype with reviews and then start selling them afterwards?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I think they're going to be for sale on the 27th. I think that's the case. Yeah.
Good to know.
And then the boards are already out there, and the memory's already out there. We're just waiting on the processors. So I think they're going to be for sale on the 27th, and then they'll start teasing the Vega Threadripper stuff for launches a couple of weeks down the road.
Very cool. Man, I went nuts with a bunch of iPerf testing with wireless adapters. And that's one of the things we'll go into on Tech Thing next week, is looking at, I think my new hobby is figuring out new and exciting ways for Windows or manufacturers to reduce Wi-Fi performance, because in one case I found a global driver that dropped performance by 50%, a Windows 10 recommended driver upgrade that dropped performance by like 60 or 70%. And then it's amazing also how much antenna location, especially on a 802.11 AC adapter, can impact performance, as in taking you from, say, 70 megabits down to 2 megabits because it fell down behind your monitor. But it was curious. It was curious to realize how messed up the driver situation is. and how little impact. You know, I wasn't doing a lot of stuff where I was, say, copying massive files over USB 3 at the same time while using a USB 3 adapter. But in most cases, if you're not like right next to your router, the throughput you're going to get on 802.11ac is not going to give you a particularly heinous USB 3 experience versus PCI Express. Also, Ethernet still rules in terms of maximum performance. But yeah, that was fun to start running through that. And Shannon got hands-on with the Bitdefender box, which is their standalone device for the Internet of Things. So, well, actually, it protects everything in your house, and as a side effect, it does that for the Internet of Things. But if you've been a little uptight about keeping your network safe, that might be something worth looking at. Although it turns out they're releasing a brand new one at the end of this year, which is going to be a significant improvement in terms of processing power, especially if you try to operate it as a standalone device. The Bitdefender box is perhaps the worst standalone router ever. You know, in terms of, you know, how it performs versus its competitors. But go to techthing.com and check the video on that for the whole story. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here on This Week in Computer Hardware. You can find more of our episodes at twit.tv/TWICH. And we invite you to go over there, find our older episodes, learn how to subscribe to the show. You can find Ryan at PCPro.com. You can find me at TechThing.com and AVXL.com. And as always, we want to thank you so much for joining us. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.